This is the Definitely Uncertain podcast, brought to you by Gold Rock Capital. Each week, we look at how high net worth families can improve their lives, decisions, and investments in a deeply uncertain world. We always aim to provide practical information, even if we can't offer specific investment advice.
Welcome to the Definitely Uncertain podcast by Gold Rock Capital. My name is David Ram, and I'm a partner at Gold Rock Capital, the more than 20-year-old multifamily office servicing high net worth investors in Israel and around the world. And with me today again is Zach McCarroll, who's a partner at Apogem Capital, a $37 billion alternative asset manager. And Zach oversees the Real Assets Investment Program. Welcome, Zach.
Thank you. It's been Good to see you again. Since we've done this.
Absolutely.
Different circumstances.
Very different circumstances. The last time you and I chatted on the podcast, it was May 2020. I think supply and demand of the energy market, both supply and demand, just completely crashed. It was absolute turmoil. What have you been doing over the past couple of years in the energy investment universe since those COVID days, those early COVID days?
Yeah, you're right. That was the last conversation. I affectionately refer to that as Armageddon. Right.
The event you
could not predict occurred. And that while we were all going through the emotional baggage and kind of strain related to COVID, lockdowns, mandates, whatever it may be, the energy markets themselves, from a investment and sector perspective, it was truly an uncertain future. We had a scenario that no one could have predicted that had a draconian impact on global demand, which changed the behavior pattern for investment supply for years, if not decades. And so what we immediately focused on with our own portfolio was we have to get costs under control. We have to make sure that our companies survive and that we put ourselves in a position that when the world normalizes, we can take advantage of that. The thing I'm most proud of for our prior two portfolios was that our loss ratio was 2% in a situation where demand on a global basis fell by over 40% and rig activity in North America fell by 80%.
Wow.
And our first goal is we need to protect capital. And I feel like we did that in an environment that we could not have possibly predicted.
How long did that demand drop off or that rig count drop off? How long did it take to get back to a normalized level pre-COVID?
Yeah, so really you saw no change in activity. And I'm going to speak in generalities, right?
Yeah, of course. We could
go to the data and it would probably be a little bit different, but generally nothing happened in 2020. You had a 6 to 9 month period where no one knew what to expect. It wasn't really until we got to 2021, there was, I think, really a fatigue as well as an optimism of we've got to go forward. We cannot continue to be here. And that was really somewhat
the vaccine. The vaccine came online in December of
2020. It was vaccines. We had a number of different countries or a number of different states or localities that took a different approach.
Yeah.
Some opened up faster than others. There just became more of a willingness to take risk and recognize that we have to resume activity. And the irony in a lot of that is that for many comfortable or affluent individuals, it was okay to stay and work from home.
But absolutely.
For any type of industry or delivery of healthcare or food or manufacturing, like everybody was back on site in April of 2020. And so there was a dichotomy that had to be worked through for us to get to a point where we stabilized. What I would say happened is when we got to the second half of 2021, you began to see a change in sentiment relative to, okay, like we can go forward, we can begin to think about what the future holds, how we want to grow, what that could look like. But you had a dramatic shift in behavior and the way that would be implemented. If you fast forward another 6 months, right, at the end of 2021, we were still in $60 oil and $3 natural gas in the US. Another event that no one necessarily predicted, or at least not on a wide scale, was the Russia-Ukraine invasion and what that means for global coordination around energy policy, what it means for embedded assets, and what it means for pricing going forward. If you had told me in December of 2021, we would see $120 oil and $9 gas, I would have told you were crazy.
But now oil prices are actually at the levels that were prior to the invasion. So yeah, I'm sure Putin had something to do with it, but at the end of the day, there was $90 oil prior to January 2022, I believe.
Yeah, well, no. So at the end of the year, we were at roughly $65 oil at the end of 2021. We creeped up around 70 or so before pre-Russia Ukraine. But the real driver for the price and the increase did happen to coincide with the geopolitical risk went up substantially. That also is coupled with the fact that if you look at changing behavior of traditional energy companies from the time that COVID occurred to where we are today, they completely changed their operating model, meaning they were no longer focused on growth, specifically North American shale, which was the marginal global supplier.
Shale is for natural gas.
That's for gas and oil.
Gas and oil. Okay.
And just to be clear for anybody listening, when I say gas, I'm talking about natural gas, not gasoline.
Right.
Gasoline is the refined product from a barrel of oil. Pre-COVID, the U.S. shale industry from 2004 until 2020 operated on a growth at all costs. They had access to high-yield financing. The public markets were willing to support them. And what you saw was a growth mindset where the reinvestment rate, meaning for every dollar of cash they generated, they were investing more than a dollar. So call it 100% reinvestment rate. Essentially, they were following a pattern that we will have more cash flow in the future. So we're going to invest for that today. But they were living beyond their means.
Yeah.
And you saw it in public equity performance from 2012 to 2020. Energy was flat when the rest of the market was going up. So they were destroying shareholder value by pursuing that model. Somewhere around 2018, you began to see a bit more discipline from the shale companies because the financing markets were no longer open. They were not able to roll their debt. They had to be more pragmatic in how they thought about it. And the rhetoric around ESG and what that meant for activist investors, and you saw it with engine number one relative to Exxon, there began to be influence. COVID hits in 2020. Rig activity falls off a cliff. Pricing goes negative.
Yeah.
We had negative $27 oil and we had a dollar natural gas. No one makes money in that environment.
No.
Every company in the US immediately pivoted to do a couple of things. Number one, we've got to clean up our balance sheet, meaning if we have high cost debt, we got to get out of it. We have to refinance. We have to do whatever we can. Number two, we need to raise equity. We can't access equity markets, which means we have to start thinking about divesting non-core assets, or we have to determine what strategic assets are we going to own for the future. And then we need to write off the rest and we need to figure out how to move forward. The other thing you've seen since 2020 is the reinvestment rate for onshore US oil and gas companies has averaged about 40%, meaning for every dollar they generate, they're only reinvesting 40 cents.
As opposed to the 100% prior, you're saying.
Exactly. And that 40% reinvestment rate is all-time lows. And what it essentially signals is a return to the pre-shale operating model for these natural resource companies, which was we need to be financially sound from a balance sheet perspective. We need to be disciplined on how we reinvest our money for future supply. And we need to focus on dividend and cash flow return to our shareholders. And so you've seen that since COVID, we've had record quarterly profits and cash creation from shale over the last 2 years. And there's no catalyst that's going to change that behavior because the current political climate towards traditional energy, there is a threat at all times that the ultimate desire is we want to put you out of business.
Right.
And so what's happening is you're seeing companies operate with the assumption that they need to essentially blow down their assets and pay out cash flow because there is no assumption of a terminal value.
And the government is not incentivizing with longer term promises of any sort.
There's no long-term promise to help them grow. There's no long term promise. There's no regulatory change in permitting. So you have a situation where in the short term, you have a political climate where they want increased production, but they also want to say, we're going to put you out of business as soon as we can. And so there's no management team that's going to take that trade. So, you know, what you've seen is remarkable discipline from the public companies, even in this commodity price environment for oil and gas that has more than doubled since the post-Russia-Ukraine war. You have a scenario where the public companies have not changed their drilling activity or profile. Most of the increase in drilling activity has all come from the private operators. And so the public companies have stayed disciplined.
Interesting.
I believe that will persist. And I'll stop there for a minute, David. So yeah, that's so kind of what's changed.
So there's a couple of things that I want to drill in a little bit more into the comments you're making. One relates to just broader policy, interactive policy amongst different Western countries to understand how they're going to all address supply requirements towards the market demand in the future. I want to talk about that because that also relates to the war as well. And the second thing I want to talk about now, just make sure I understand appropriately around the public markets, is that you mentioned there's been basically a shift in how they've been operating since about 2018 or so. Does that mean that the public markets of energy is a more attractive market? Because over the past many years, you mentioned 2012 to 2018 or so, where it was flat while the market was double digit annualized. Has that changed how these companies operate? Is there more of a long-term shareholder value approach where maybe it's an investable asset class again?
It's a great question. It's more attractive than it was. We'll say that.
Okay.
The thesis, so look, I like companies where I see management buying back their shares and I see them distributing capital, right? Traditional value-oriented investment.
Right.
If you look at a number of metrics relative to public energy stocks, whether or not it's upstream or it's service-related businesses, their earnings multiples are nowhere near market norm, meaning they are trading at a discount, even with the run-up post Russia, Ukraine, they've rolled over a bit. They are far more attractive than they used to be. And the longer that they adopt the current posture of living within cash flow, distributing capital, and being focused on a value-based philosophy,
yeah,
the more attractive they will be longer term.
That's interesting, because obviously we've spoken about it internally as to how to best gain access to the energy market for, as an investor for our clients. And there's public markets, there's private markets, there's hedge funds, there's maybe commodity trading, there's different ways you can do it. Not all of them are efficient or attractive, but one of the problems I've always found in the public markets has been that the volatility is high and the returns are lower. So that may be good for hedge funds, but it ain't good for long-term capital growth for a long investor. But but maybe it's changing nowadays. And just to go back to the second part of the question, which relates a lot.
Can I say one thing on that?
Go for it.
That's why I believe these assets are best held in the private markets. It's why I believe that having control of the asset and having a conservative balance sheet, so high equity concentration capital structures, is the appropriate way to maximize value in these assets. I think you buy them at a better price. I think you have more strategic influence over the development of the asset, the distribution of cash flow, and then the potential for monetization in other avenues, whether or not it is a re-rating in the space generally, it is a higher commodity price environment, it's better operating statistics and metrics, which lead to higher margins and a capture of that, or the ability to consider refinancing pending what the debt and the capital markets will provide. I always struggle in the public markets because there will consistently be a relative valuation that's applied to any sector to the broader market.
Yep.
And let's make no mistake, if there are headwinds to the broader market and equities are being sold off, it doesn't matter how disciplined the energy companies are going to be, the public companies are going to get hit just like the broader market.
Absolutely. That sounds like there may be an opportunity, especially when you mentioned about growth, expansion growth of companies that the private companies in North America seem to be more open-minded potentially around their growth strategy versus the public companies. Maybe there's a lot of opportunities in the private markets to go to the public markets and take them private. I assume there's a lot of chatter about that now.
Yeah, so there are a couple of things on that. We had one partner who went the opposite way at the depth of the market. They acquired Penn Virginia, turned it into Ranger Resources, and it's going to be a very good win for us. You had the disconnect in public-private valuation at that point in time, and really excited about where that company is heading. But what I would say is in the private markets, you ask what we've been doing in this space over the last 2 years. There has been such extreme capital flight from traditional energy investment. Yeah. When the world, and because of Russia, Ukraine, it is not going away anytime soon. Global demand is back above pre-pandemic levels, and the need for natural gas as a transition fuel globally has only been exacerbated.
Transition fuel meaning transition from hydrocarbon fossil fuel to the renewable energy market, I assume. Yes. Meaning
that whatever the narrative may be and however we need to change the narrative to meet the base and the constituent, that's what we're seeing. And I'll come back to that on Russia-Ukraine, but it's the point that even though Germany was celebrated as having forward-thinking energy policy,
yeah.
Unfortunately, with the invasion of Russia-Ukraine, they are in a very compromised position for at least a decade. They're already burning more coal than they were burning pre-energy transition, or at least the policies that they were looking to pursue.
Yeah.
They've already declared natural gas as a transition fuel going forward. They've already allowed nuclear to those that were going to be shut down, not to be shut down. And they are considering permitting for more nuclear installation and development, which candidly is the only way to create baseload power with no emissions, right? So if climate is your biggest concern and you don't also support nuclear installation, there's a dissonance there of understanding of what we need from a baseload capacity for energy.
Yeah. First of all, baseload power versus, I assume, intermittent power, where you have an ability to provide 24/7 electricity versus intermittent, meaning if the sun's out, you get it. If the wind's blowing, you get it. If not, you don't. You need a constant provision of power or else you're out of luck. So in terms of those policies in Europe and the war that's been going on, unfortunately, in the Ukraine, as you pointed out correctly, Europe has always been looked at as forward-thinking policy. But the reality was they needed that baseload supply from somewhere. All they did politically was take it off their, so to speak, corporate balance sheet, their country balance sheets. They took it off their responsibility and started buying from less friendly countries, it seems.
David, there's a chart where you can look at Russia natural gas exports into Europe and then Europe's shale gas production.
Exactly.
And they are over the last decade and they are exactly inverted.
Exactly.
Right?
So they took it off. So Germany, Spain, whoever stopped doing domestic production of natural gas, which is a great baseload input. You did intermittent supply instead and then bought their baseload from Russia, essentially.
That's exactly right.
Instead of having forward thinking policy, that was actually a bit of a folly, it seems. And the folly is coming home to roost a little bit. So what is going to happen? Forget about winter 2022, which is going to be difficult in Germany or other countries. What are we thinking about in 1 year, 2 year, 3 year plans in order to make sure the Western world stays as developed countries with the lights on, the cars running, et cetera?
Look, I think it's a real risk. I also don't want to exaggerate the risk for the purpose of fear. But I will say this, I am concerned for Europe. The situation that Europe is in with the dependence on Russian gas is critical. And there are no near-term solutions to immediately offset the loss of that supply.
Yeah.
And there will be coordinated and unintended consequences in countries that may not even be Germany, but others, because they can't get delivery of resources and energy supply when it's needed most. You don't have constant energy demand on a daily basis throughout the year.
Right.
There are different seasons of how that works. And the winter is going to be difficult because natural gas is one of the heating fuels that is required when demand goes up. And so my fear and what Europe's goal now is that there's a possibility that shale gas from the US can be imported to Europe via LNG in sufficient quantities over a rapid enough period of time to mitigate the consequences that they're in today. I don't think that's possible, not within the timeline that is being suggested.
Yeah.
For a couple of reasons. One, natural gas prices have more than doubled in the US since Russia-Ukraine.
Yeah.
Number two, they've more than doubled in Europe, which were already five times higher than US natural gas prices. And number three, gas prices in Asia are already more expensive, are still more expensive. So in the event that the U.S. had the ability to permit pipelines, storage facilities, LNG export terminals, if we actually had the ability to do that in a rapid way, it is possible we could send more exports to Europe, which we're already at essentially 100% of our export capacity. But the problem is, if you're an LNG exporter, you get a better price in Asia.
Yeah.
So
why would a North American natural gas provider ever sell locally in North America if they can get five times the price doing liquid natural gas to Europe, or even more, as you're mentioning, in Asia? Why is there ever a local requirement?
There's incremental costs and transport and infrastructure and things that you have to own in order to be able to do that. And I'd also say that the quantities, for instance, if you look at like the Permian Basin in Texas, which is primarily an oil producer, another fallacy is people think that when you drill a oil well, you only get oil, right? You don't. You get all sorts of hydrocarbons. You get oil, you get gas, you get liquids, and then you have to capture it. You have to separate it and distribute it. And so for an oil producer in the Permian who has associated natural gas from their production, you know, their value of their business is producing petroleum. The natural gas is an offset quantity whereby they just want to monetize it as quickly as possible. So they're going to sell it into the pipeline and then let the midstream operators and or the ultimate consumers and utilities decide how it should be utilized. So that's one answer to the question. I'm sure there are many more, but that's
right.
Gives you a little bit of color.
Fair enough. So Europe needs gas to heat their homes. They added coal recently, which is ironic, but they're doing it and it's cheap, it's fast. They actually have, I think, supply problems on coal as well. But in terms of keeping the lights on, heating their homes, and then trying to, I assume, isolate countries like Russia, Iran, Venezuela, and others, it seems to be a challenge moving forward that only could be solved by massive investment in expansion of North American or European natural gas and oil. I don't know what else, unfortunately, to say. That's what we're hearing. It sounds like that's years and years away, if ever. So we may be in a rough patch, it sounds.
Yeah, and look, we've known each other long enough. I'm never going to try to predict where pricing is going to go. Never going to try to predict what technology gets adopted.
Right.
We don't know is the answer. But my opinion is that if you look globally over centuries, right? The way that we lift people out of poverty is low-cost, reliable energy. My opinion is that nation states are going to function a lot like people, which means they're going to act in their own best interest. And so when China, India, Africa, the Middle East, South America decide that they want to lift their citizens out of poverty and begin to bring them more in line with Western standards, the cheapest and most efficient way for them to do that is the continued use of fossil fuels, petroleum, natural gas, liquids, coal. The dirty secret is that renewables make up such a small percentage of global energy kind of supply. And even at rapid growth rates, if other countries continue to grow and move up that S-curve of affluence, petroleum demand, natural gas demand is going to continue to grow at a pretty consistent rate, which means we have to continue to invest in supply, future supply.
Yeah.
The irony of all this is that the U.S. public operators who have pivoted now to a value-based kind of model whereby
cash flow generation as opposed to
they're not investing in inventory for the future. And so the marginal supplier, which by the way, and arguably the most regulated environment in the world for the extraction of oil and gas. Yeah. So if you can get to the default that, you know, even if you want oil and gas to go away, it's not going away. Logically to me, you would then want it extracted in the most regulated environment possible, which happens to be North America. Right. On a global basis. The problem is there's no incentive. And so the marginal supplier of a global barrel of oil in the best market possible to do so has no incentive to invest in inventory for the long term.
For example, I believe, and you correct me if I'm wrong, in the natural gas world, there's often problems of methane that comes out. And I don't think Russia or other countries like Russia our focus on methane capture.
Don't care.
Yeah, they don't care, which is probably one of the largest pollutants in the natural gas process, because the carbon emission issue of natural gas is quite a bit lower than coal or other fossil fuels. But the methane, it seems to be quite pollutant, but they have a capture solution in the U.S. for that, in North America for that.
Right. And we will continue to find technologies around carbon capture and emissions reduction, and those things are good, right? Yeah. Like we need to continue to be a better steward of our resource. I just want us to have a pragmatic conversation of what trade-offs are we making and what is realistic given global energy demand going forward, right? Yeah. I've said this to you before, but when we're thinking environmental impact, you know, 100-megawatt natural gas plant takes 2 acres of land, and 100-megawatt solar farm takes 7,000 acres.
Right? Yeah.
Plus, you have to get the panels.
That's a lot of desert turtles.
That's right. Well, again, the panels are produced in China.
Yeah.
We were laughing earlier about the fact, maybe laugh is the wrong word, but we were commenting earlier on the fact that China now, after Pelosi's Taiwan visit, has cut off military and climate discussions with the U.S. They produce 90% of the solar panels globally. They're also the largest emitter of carbon on the planet. So if they're not going to be committed, then what are we doing?
Yeah, exactly. Right? So let's bring it home with one interesting investment tip, but you can't sell me your business. So only something else out there, something specific, any idea, I'd love to hear an interesting investment idea off the top of your head or whatever you could think of that would be interesting for the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years or so in the energy or natural resources space. You could pick anything you want. What would be something that you're most excited about that you think will have government support, investor support, consumer support, that you think is a winner?
That's a great question. I'm going to hedge a little bit on this.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to try to pick something that's liquid, right? So I'm going to try to stay in the equity markets. So okay. That's something that could be implemented instead of, hey, you've got to go find somebody doing something super unique and different. I think that there is a scenario where the oilfield service markets could be very well positioned for material outperformance. And I say that because in the U.S., we've had a 2-year period where there was such a supply shock, and the rig counts and activity were laid down to such an extreme degree that the labor went. If you were living in West Texas and you were working on rigs at the end of 2019, by the end of 2020, you went into construction and building houses, and you're never coming back to the oil industry. It's too extreme. It's too volatile, all that. So I think you have a labor shortage. Number two, I think when we look globally and we hear this commentary around supply chain constraints, the ability to access steel, the ability to get materials, drill pipe casing, whatever it may be, there's a backup, right? And there's a delay on getting those things. And so how do you expedite that? You pay more. And number three, we have a hydrocarbon market where, in my opinion, the floor pricing for both natural gas and oil has gone up materially for the next 2 to 5 years, which means that the cost structure of extracting and producing is going to follow, but it's lagging. And so I think there's a scenario where there can be some pretty interesting oilfield service companies that, again, live through their own Armageddon in 2020 and 2021. And if they survive and they have healthy balance sheets and they have some cash for growth and they have proprietary equipment and or people, that they could be really well positioned to capture more margin going forward.
Interesting. That's an interesting tip. I like that. This has been great, Zach. It's always fun talking with you and getting an update on the energy space, which is just a crazy situation going on in the world. And that was really helpful for all of us. So thanks so much for joining us. And we hope to have you again in the future, as things I'm sure will continue to be volatile in the energy space. And I want to thank all the listeners for listening, and we'll see you next time. Thanks so much.
Wonderful. Thanks for having me.